Welcome to the Untold Civil War Podcast. I'm Paul, your host, and before we get started, I just want to mention a new sponsor. Yes, the podcast is growing, and my sponsors really keep this project alive. This particular sponsor is special to me because Polar, or Path of Least Resistance, is an organization that supports veterans and is run by my buddy who graduated basic training with me. As he puts it, post-service is a difficult transition. One of the deficiencies during separation that veterans find difficult is the loss of camaraderie and relationships. Polar is dedicated to bring service members together to help facilitate programming that will bring the community together. He's organized several retreats for veterans. Learn more about them in the link in the show notes. But now, slap some bacon on a biscuit and mount up. We're burning daylight, and we need to delve into some untold Civil War. So tonight I sit with the Licensed Battlefield Guides of Gettysburg. In the Civil War community, they are nothing less than rock stars. The Licensed Battlefield Guides are the oldest professional guide service in the United States. And tonight we'll be learning about these individual guides as well as the organization itself. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Definitely our pleasure.
And if we could just go around so everyone can put a name to the voice, because it is only audio. Could you introduce yourselves, please?
This is Sue Boardman.
Hi, this is Jim Hessler. Been a battlefield guide since 2003.
Jesse Wheedleton. I've been a battlefield guide since they offered the test last 2018.
Hello, this is Fred Hawthorne.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I guess we can start with Jesse. How did the licensed battlefield guides get their start, and when did you learn about the guide service?
It's kind of hard to say, I guess, when guiding started, because people started to pay people to lead them out to the battlefield to find graves of soldiers that were buried in the field. So a visitor started to travel here pretty shortly after the battle. But guides were officially licensed in 1915 when the War Department started issuing licenses. And I really didn't know that battlefield guides existed, even though I grew up not very far from the battlefield. I just thought it would be fun to get a summer job on the park. 2011, I started riding along on the Segway tours as a safety person, kind of like a horse wrangler, but just to wrangle stray Segways back onto the road while the guides gave the tour. And other battlefield guides, like the 10 or so that were brave enough to ride a Segway and give the tour, encouraged me to do this for a living. So I just kind of got absorbed into the fold. But Fred wrote the history of the guide, so he might be a better person to go into the details of.
Well, no worries. I think, yes, we'll hand it over to Fred here. So Fred, what inspired you to become a guide? And can you tell us a little bit more about the origins of the guiding?
Nothing quite as exotic as they do today. Back in 1980, they put an ad in a newspaper that they were going to offer a guide test. I decided to take it. Ad was in there in July. The test was in September. I was guiding by November. Didn't think about it. Didn't know about it. Just seemed an interesting thing to do. And just covered it pretty well about what happened with the origins of guiding. It was people coming here originally to look for loved ones later on, just after the war. A guy named William Holdsworth probably is the first true battlefield guide who does it for pay. And he's active by at least 1866.
And Sue, maybe we can bring you in here. What inspired you to become a guide?
I actually grew to love history in middle age. I kind of hated it in school. But what drew me to it was I encountered the stories of soldiers that lived back home where I'm from, which is in particular the 147th Regiment. And in following their story, of course, it led me here. And then this being a really cool place, I kept returning here. And then eventually developed an interest in giving a shot. However, I will be honest with you, most guides on the force take years to prepare, and I am so impressed with Fred getting his notice in the summer and being a guide by November. That's incredible.
And Jim, when did you become a guide, and what inspired you to become a guide?
Somewhat like Sue, my love for Gettysburg and the Civil War began more in adulthood, but probably about in the early to mid 1990s, I was given the book, The Killer Angels, as a gift, and I kind of fell in love with Gettysburg based and the Civil War based on that. So mid-1990s, we started coming to Gettysburg more often on vacations and leisure trips and things like that. And, you know, I saw these battlefield guides on the field, people going around and, you know, more or less being paid to talk about the battle. And I thought, you know, wow, what a cool occupation that would be. Guys like Fred Hawthorne, who was guiding at that time. And then later Sue was guiding when I started to study. So I just thought it would be a cool job. And we moved here about the year 2000. And at that time, I kind of put my name in the hat for the guide exam. And I took the exam in 2002 and subsequently passed from that.
Fantastic. And I think maybe we should just, before we go any further, because I want to know more about the exam process. Maybe Fred, if you want to explain to people, if we don't know already, what exactly, when we're talking about licensed battlefield guides, who are these characters? I mean, what exactly do they do?
It's tough. A lot of stuff. Mainly give tours to people of the battlefield of Gettysburg in a very concise manner. We're not talking about the multi-hour or multi-day tours that special people want to come and get. We're talking about average tours for average people. When we started out touring way back in the 19th century, it was largely veterans who were coming back here with their families that people, local people, were taking around in their carriages. I'd say after 1913, it became much more of a personal tour of people who've never been here before, just coming to see what the field was like. And that stayed pretty much the same up through about the time, I'd say the Killer Angels, Gettysburg phenomena of the 1990s, when we started to have more and more special types of tours. I can't remember too many all day, all weekend tours given in the 1980s and early 1990s. I don't remember many military groups coming here in that time. It's always families coming here and school kids coming here, and senior citizens coming here, and World War II veterans and Korea War veterans coming on bus trips. The big change came in the early 1990s to what we have today. And I guess by about that time is when, I know Jess can probably tell you when, but the Segway tours started, horseback tours started, buggy tours started, you name it, everything but rollerblade tours. We seem to have all kind of touring today. That just did not exist prior to the 1990s.
So we've seen a great change with how the tours are given. Have we seen a change with how people became guides in the process of actually the application of becoming a guide?
Not really. It's always consisted of a test written. I think you can probably talk about every guide and they're going to say that their test that they took was the hardest test ever given by OBGs. Back late 1980s, when computers started coming out, the guide supervisor at that time, John Andrews, came to me because I knew a little bit about computers, and he said he wanted to digitize all former guide tests. So I may be the only person seeing every single guide test that's ever been given since 1915. And I know from 1915 till 1929, the test was exclusively an essay test. And I think that was probably the hardest type of test for these people to take. I mean, literally they sat down, they asked you a question and they gave you half an hour, 45 minutes to write on that. So that was not only testing the knowledge of these previously unlicensed guides, but it also was testing their ability to express themselves. That's all combined in one package. Today, well, let's say the test I took, that was a multiple choice, fill in the blank, true false test that you took. And based on that, they would take anybody above a 75% and then you qualify to take an oral exam. That's essentially the same process we have today, except we've now reintroduced elements to try to get rid of people who just can't talk, people that can't express themselves, people that don't know how to deal with, you know, there's a lot of people that know a lot of information, but being able to take that information and give it to another person, that's a special art. And for a long time in the early eras when I took my test, we didn't have that. So we didn't get an opportunity to actually find out, can this person actually talk for 2 hours in a car, until we took them out on an oral exam and spent time with them. So a lot of the new stuff that's been put on that these guys went through, there are elements that were put in to try to weed out communication problems before you ever get to the final oral exam phase.
You know, the other thing I'll just add too is, you have to remember the candidates coming in today have so much access to information. I mean, there's more Gettysburg books than ever before. There's more maps, more map books, map programs, internet resources than ever before. So the exam process has to be comprehensive, because if you just want to know a question about the Battle of Gettysburg, you can Google it today. So again, really with all the information that's available to people, the process itself really has to be, you know, as comprehensive as it currently is.
Time to get the Christmas shopping done. If you've waited this long, you probably are in a panic trying to figure out what to buy that Civil War buff in your family. The Excelsior Brigade deals in the finest, highest grade and quality relics of the war. Check out their wares at the link in the show notes and let them help you with your Christmas shopping list.
Maybe Sue can chime in a little bit. Can you talk about maybe specific questions one might see or maybe specific things someone should work on in order to be successful on the test?
That actually changes, it seems, by era. But for example, on my test, there were book titles that you had to match with authors, and that obviously changes as a newer books come on the scene. I know they added an element of photographing monuments. You had to identify monuments, which is relatively new on the exams. But I will tell you, the test I took in the mid-90s, I thought was hard until I proctored some of the tests, and I saw that the current, I would say in the last maybe three testing sessions, it's hard, and they're very, very competitive. And so now there isn't a cutoff, a pass fail number. Now it's you're competing against whoever else can score the highest. So you could essentially, with a really good, smart group of test takers, you could end up getting a 94 and not making the cut. And you know, that's heartbreaking for people who prepare for years to take that test.
Jesse, for your process, I mean, how did you feel? Well, did you feel that the process effectively gave you the opportunity to show your knowledge as well as your ability to speak in public?
I did. I took the last two iterations of the test, and they were 2 years apart. The first test I took, we had four phases we had to go through. We had the written test. They got rid of multiple choice because it doesn't really make sense as a guide. And we had 8 essays. So it was half a day of writing essays, which is kind of rough on your hand by the end of the day. And each of the 8 categories, you had 2 that you could pick from. So if there's one you didn't know anything about, you could just write on what you felt strongly about. We had an interview. Then we had like a kind of public speaking training phase, and then the final oral exam. The last time I took the test, they graded what was usually called charm school, where they're trying to give you pointers on how to condense and simplify what you're trying to convey to people. But they were realizing, I guess, the last time that they could tell in that phase that people weren't going to get through the driving test. So they're thinking, well, we should weed people out of that process, but it made it super stressful. So thinking that you could be cut, you know, even when you're trying to learn how to do it. I guess we kind of form this bond of being tortured the same or, you know, in similar ways, so that it's, I don't know, it kind of helps us feel like we're all connected in that way. But I mean, I felt that the questions that were asked were fair. I often find that, you know, different subject matter from, you know, the causes of the war and Reconstruction, there's so much you can talk to on a tour. You're not going to get into it a lot in 2 hours, but I found that I have used a lot of the material that I was tested on, you know, on just average tours of the battlefield.
Gift cards, socks, sweaters, not going to cut it this Christmas. Check out the Badge Maker. The reenactor in your family will never forget the Christmas you got him a period correct core badge or ID disc. Link in the show notes.
Now, I don't know if we know exactly about this, but if you are someone who takes the test or doesn't make the cut, are you allowed to take it again? Is it common for people to take the test once, twice, maybe even 3 times?
The one downside to that is when I was taking the tests, it was $50 to register. In order to weed out people who were taking it for fun, if that's a possibility, the test has become somewhat expensive. So, I mean, from what, does anybody here know the latest?
$250 was the last one.
$250. So if you wanted to take that 3 times, you're going to sink some money into that. You better be serious about it.
So you have to understand it. Before Gettysburg, the movie, you were averaging 35 or 40 people per test. And if they gave a 75% cutoff point, you could figure that at least half of those people are going to make it through that. That became manageable. Once Gettysburg came out, and I think even before that Ken Burns series on the Civil War, everybody heard about this, I think, and they thought this was an interesting thing to do. And all of a sudden, we were getting testing classes of 125 and 150. And if we continued to use, I know that back in 95 or 96, they made a really bad mistake, and that we had a really big testing class that year. And they used the thing that if you're above 75 or might have even moved it to 80%, we will guarantee you an oral exam. Well, we had like 60 or 70 people score above that, and it took them like 6 or 7 years to work through that list. So by the time you got to the person who was 7 years down the road from the test, they'd completely forgotten all of that stuff. So that's why they tried to make it a little bit more so they could, quite frankly, weed out people. So we don't have those big groups of 70 or 80 people you got to test. You guarantee them a 2-hour oral exam that takes a paid national park ranger and a licensed guide who's not getting paid, 2 hours minimum to go through the exam, another half an hour to 45 minutes to debrief and then to go in for another hour. You're talking about maybe 4 hours of a person's day to give one oral. And if they fail that oral, then you go back and you're talking about another 4-hour time commitment. So you take that time 70 people, that's a big time commitment. And I think that's where a lot of the additional steps in the testing process have come from over the years, just to try to keep that more manageable.
I need to binge history. I need more history content at my fingertips. I can't get enough of it. I subscribe to History Fix, and so should you if you suffer from the same ailment. History Fix has got some awesome documentaries and period films that will help you feed that craving for good history content when so much of TV today gets it wrong. Link in the show notes. Fred, you mentioned the National Park Service. What is the relationship the licensed battlefield guides have with the National Park Service? How do they connect?
They are the licensing agency. They are the ones who actually test you and, if approved, grant your license. It's always signed by the superintendent as the representative of the Rector National Park Service, I think what he is now. And then back in the 1915 to 1933 days, it was the park commissioners on behalf of the Secretary of War, because the War Department ran it. So we are basically their licensees. They set the rules. They set the fee structure. They set the testing process. You know, a lot of people call the Guides Association, say, we want to know something about the test. Well, we don't know anything more than anybody else because we don't make that decision. When it's time for the park to give a test, they call a group of guides in to help them with it, but it's their call. It's their test they write. It's their test that they administer, and it's their license that they will give to you.
Now, the National Park Service is all over the country. I could be wrong, but I haven't heard of licensed battlefield guides at any other battlefields. Are there other battlefield guides elsewhere on other battlefields?
If you look at the Code of Federal Regulations, it's for national military parks, and there's only 5 of those. Actually, not even that, because I think Antietam is Antietam National Battlefield. There are guides at Antietam, but they are not licensed by the Park Service. They are certified by, I think it now might be Eastern National. The only other national park that I'm aware of that has a guide service like ours is Vicksburg, which is a true national military park. Chickamauga, I think, could have them. Dilo, I think, is still a national military park. So under the park regulations, the CFR 25, whatever it is, guys, you studied that a lot earlier than I did. Those national military parks may have licensed guides.
The curious thing about the relationship is that a lot of people misunderstand that we are employees of the national park, and we are not. Mm-hmm. We are independent contractors. So we have a lot of responsibility to the park, but no bennies at all.
It's snappy uniform.
All that snappy.
You've booked the cruise to the Bahamas. You took the family to the resort in Cancun. You flew the kids out to Italy. And what did they do? Buried themselves on their phones and were glued to their social media accounts. And then they went on and flunked history class. No, no. This time you are planning a vacation with the help of Civil War trails. Walk the battlefields. See the homes that served as hospitals and Army headquarters. To be honest, this may not get the kids off their phone, but you'll have so much more fun. Link in the show notes.
Are there certain regulations or maybe certain hours that you have to perform every year in order to stay an active licensed battlefield guide?
Yes, there are 3 categories of guiding for your licensure, and that is the weekend, the part-time, which is essentially seasonal, and the full-time, which is year-round. The hours required of commitment for those particular designations is different. And so is the number of tours you are required to do per year to keep that license current.
Now, I'd love to get into this because this is probably my favorite part, or one of my favorite questions that I really wanted to get into. And that is your personal stories about some of the tours you may have been given. Interesting stories, humorous stories. Jim, would you like to talk about some of the tours you've given?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this beforehand. I really don't have anything that stands out as a sort of penultimate humorous moment. Obviously, there's a lot of humor and interaction in individual tours. And I think we've all had moments of mistakenly getting in somebody else's car or starting to get into somebody else's car and things of that nature. Nothing like that, you know, stands out. I've had some moving experiences where descendants have been on tours, and sometimes by surprise, you know, you're talking about a certain general and a guy in the audience raises his hand and says, well, that, you know, Richard Ewell was my great, great grandfather sort of thing. I mean, I've had that type of experience. I took a school group one time through the National Cemetery, and this particular school group seemed to be focused very heavily on Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address. So we went into the cemetery and they recited the Gettysburg Address. And then one little girl came up to me afterwards and gave me a big hug and said, oh, I'll never forget you kind of thing. So, you know, those are certainly memorable things. As far as a humorous question, you know, we always hear, you know, people are always asking us what's the dumbest question or the worst question you've ever received on a tour. I don't, for the most part, I don't really think there are dumb questions. You know, the old wives' tale, like why didn't the soldiers hide behind monuments and things like that. I haven't personally experienced a lot at that level during my career. I did have one woman one time ask, how did they get the horses on the monuments to come back here and pose for the statues? So, you know, it's kind of a memorable question. But I think overall, as long as somebody's asking questions, it means they're interested. And ultimately, that's what our job is to, you know, try to pique their interest and give them as much information as we can.
Jesse, what sort of tours have you given and what sort of people have you given tours to?
Well, when you were asking about funny stories, I have tons from my Segway days before I became a licensed guide, but I guess other licensed guides were on the tour. But so I still give some of the Segway tours now as a guide, but I give a lot of bicycle tours, which can be tough because no matter what pace you ride, there are still tons of hills. I always say, nothing's flat in Gettysburg, no matter what you're talking about. If you're talking about the open fields of Picket Stars, they might be open, but they're not flat. And so I do a lot of those. And then I give bus tours and then just the normal driving tours where we get in and drive the customer's vehicle. And I had perhaps an interesting experience. I had a woman who she and her husband were from like London, and they were older, and they had driven their rental car from Philadelphia, and they already had like a little fender bender with their rental car, pulling it into the bed and breakfast that they were in. So they didn't want me to drive it. The woman insisted on driving, and she said, I'm sorry, but I'm not very good at automatic. She thought driving an automatic car was harder than a stick shift. And pulling out of the parking lot, she was jerking it like she was just learning stick shift for the first time. She was driving a regular car. And I was sitting in the back seat giving them the tour. And there were quite a few scary moments where I kind of feared for my life. Like looking back on it, I should have just driven them back and just had them, you know, just taken them in my car, you know, but it's just not something we're really supposed to do. One story that comes to me, we have an office where people call in and ask for, you know, special tours, sometimes just a regular tour, but we get to call them personally and talk to them before they go out. And this woman said she would be bringing her grandson, who was 6 years old, and he was a Civil War buff. So I'm thinking, okay, you're right. But when they showed up, sure enough, this kid has his binoculars and he is enthusiastic about the Civil War, and everywhere he goes to Civil War battlefields, he would buy something small and he'd put it in his little shoebox like under his bed. So at Gettysburg, it was a little Gettysburg address that he bought. So we just went around trying to find monuments with binoculars and getting his picture taken next to them. But I'm often impressed with the younger kids that are still, you know, so into this. You know, 11, 13 is an age where I find that people really start to get attached to this.
You know, I maybe should have added in my answer too. These are not just Americans we're talking about. We get visitors from other countries, and very often you'll have people on the tour, sometimes entire groups who don't speak the English language, or you might have a foreign speaking group and one interpreter. So obviously that can be a challenge if you've got nobody on the tour who understands a bloody word you're saying. So, and you do a lot of pointing, and you know, if you see smiles and recognition, you hope you're kind of getting through to them.
Sue, with your tours, what could you say? Which was the most farthest away visitor, or the visitor from the farthest country in one of your tours? Do you recall?
Yes, I actually do. And it was kind of nerve-wracking. I was asked by the U.S. War College to be the guide for a group of Afghan soldiers. And in the Afghan army, their religion is the same thing as their culture. I mean, so they're very religious as far as their own unique religion is concerned. So I was very uncomfortable. But then they told me that the reason they asked me to do it was because they were trying to defy Middle Eastern culture vis-a-vis women. So, you know, over there, no way would a woman be a public guide. So they were deliberately trying to get a guide to do it just to push the envelope. So I gave them a tour, and throughout the tour, there was four men. Three of them were very engaged and talking to me, but the head guy, who's really high ranking military official, didn't have anything to say. He was very, like, very stern. So when it was all done, the handler came to me and said, "I hope you weren't offended that he didn't talk. Last night in Washington, D.C., those other three went to Hooters, and that guy was too busy calling them infidels to pay any attention to what else was going on the itinerary. So I guess it wasn't me. It was just their behavior in the States." That one, and I had some Chinese diplomats. So I went next door to, my husband had a shop downtown. So next door was, Ping's restaurant, was Chinese restaurant. And I went over there and I asked them to tell me how to say welcome in Chinese. So they gave me a piece of paper and kind of practiced with me to say it. And then they hit me on the way out the door with, "You know that there's some like five dozen dialects in China." So I said, "Okay." They said, "Let's give you another one." So I get on the bus and there's everybody sitting there with their uniforms and their medals on, and they're all looking kind of scary. And I tried the first one and I said what I said, and everybody just gave me a blank look. So the second thing I said resonated and we were cool until we got to the very end. When we got to the end, they hadn't been very interactive because there was a language barrier. And, you know, it's really hard to work through an interpreter when you're trying to, you know, make nuances to the story. So I, at the very end, I was like taking the bus through the old cyclorama lot, and I started on the National Cemetery and Lincoln. And all of a sudden, the whole bus became animated. And everybody's shaking their head going, "Ah, Rinkin, Rinkin." It's like, I should have started with Rinkin. I probably would have got further.
In a time when a good mag is hard to come by, check out our sponsor, Military Images Magazine. They have great content and are very quick to answer any questions you may email them. I know several authors who were greatly assisted by the help and research of Ron Coddington, the editor. Link in the show notes. Well, Fred, you mentioned giving tours to veterans from the Korean War and such. How is that experience? I mean, they may have served overseas, but is there some sort of connection they can find on the battlefields here in the United States, especially at Gettysburg?
Military experience is always, soldiers can always relate to it. World War II veterans, I think, were very numerous in the 1980s. You still had them relatively spry. You had a lot of reunions in this area, and they always come through Gettysburg, and you could touch them pretty easily with the stories that you tell on it. Also found out in the 80s, it was much more common, I think, than these folks have ever had, to have grandchildren and children of Civil War veterans. I know in my experience in the 80s, I had two children of Civil War veterans. These were born in the 1920s, 19-teens to Civil War fathers and much younger mothers. I can remember one instance where the woman who was now a grandmother in her own right was bringing her grandchildren here, specifically because her father had fought in the wheat field, had been wounded in the wheat field. And as he lay in the wheat field wounded, he had written a letter to his parents because he didn't think he was going to survive. And she had this letter. And she said, told me that when she was a little girl, about the age of her grandchildren, he had brought her here, took her in the wheat field and gave her that letter. And she wanted to do the same thing. That was the first request she made for me at the visitor center. She told me the story and she said, "Do you know where this is?" I said, "I know exactly where it is." So I took her to the regimental marker where she then told her children and brought that letter out, which looked like to me it had bloodstains on it. I mean, you didn't get that kind of stuff. That generation's died off now too, pretty much. I don't know, World War II veterans, the Korean veterans, I didn't see that. Well, I will say this fall have a group of Vietnam veterans. I hadn't seen it from that generation yet. But I did the World War II and Korea generation. Those are mostly all gone now. You just don't see bus groups of them coming in. You may see a car with an elderly fella in it who fought in the Korean War, but not like we did in the 80s.
Well, Fred, I know you might get upset with this next question, but is there a favorite part of the battlefield? Can you say there's a favorite part of the battlefield that you like to take people or talk about?
No. Now, honestly, in my years, it changes. And I think that's natural with any person who's guiding for a long time, or even for a few years. Just for your own sanity, you've got to switch it up. I know back when I started guiding, my favorite spot was the cemetery. We were required to do the cemetery as part of our tour. And back then, the tour route went into it. I really enjoyed that. Then in 1989, when they closed the cemetery, I think the southern part of the battlefield became very interesting to me. Now, I guess because of Little Round Top and Joshua Chamberlain, I've kind of reacted violently against it, just in reaction to the Chamberlain myth. And now I'm doing more of the angle. Culpsill, I'm probably one of the few guides who do Culpsill every single tour I take. I enjoy going over there. I enjoy taking people over there and talking about it. So it changes over the years. You know, who knows, 50 years from now, if I'm still guiding at 130, might be Cavalry Field. It's the only place I haven't really ever liked.
Well, Jim, what's the flavor of the day for you this month? What part of the battlefield are you looking at?
Yeah, I would. First of all, I would echo what Fred said in terms of it changing over time. And I think that's a natural thing. And I think that's a good thing, so that you don't get bored or stale on one topic. I enjoy walking Pickett's Charge. You know, I do a lot of that. And obviously walking it gets you out of the car and it gets you on the ground and you can, and more of a visceral experience to try to, you know, to try to experience what it might have been like for the men who made that assault. I've also always been, some of them know this, I've always been interested in the life and times of Dan Sickles. And because of that, I feel like the Peach Orchard has always been relatively unappreciated as people have focused on Little Round Top and the wheat field and things like that. So I've always been a Peach Orchard guy. Last but not least, I'm a big East Cavalry Field enthusiast. So I do actually get over there. You know, if I get over there 10 or 15 times a year, that's still a lot comparatively, because the typical person who comes tends to not ask to go over there. But I think between, you know, Pickett, the Peach Orchard and East Cavalry Field, they kind of keep me on my toes.
Jesse, you mentioned actually riding bicycles on the battlefield and doing tours and different modes of transportation. Are there locations on the battlefield that you want to mention that people should go see that might be actually hard to reach via foot? Maybe you do need the bicycle or something interesting in that regard?
There is a special section of the battlefield that when you find it, it's like this weird little utopia in the middle of nowhere. And it's a place called Lost Avenue, but it's mostly surrounded by private property. But the gentleman who owns the farm at the bottom of the hill, Dean Schultz, is really lets guides take people up there through his property and just give them a little heads up. And it's an interesting story up there, and it's better to hear Dean tell it. We made him an honorary battlefield guide because he knows so much and he's done so much to preserve the field. On Wolf Hill is where this little section is, but there are, you know, full-size monuments to the regiments, just like you see everywhere else with all the regiments up there. And he takes care of what the Park Service cannot. So that's kind of I think it's on the list of most Gettysburg buffs to visit that at some point. But yeah, I'd say there are a lot of stories. The deeper you dig on Culpsill, there's just a lot of little stories all over the place. And so many monuments and, you know, things trying to reach out to you over there.
Well, Sue, besides the Lincoln part being so having such emotional impact with people, are there other parts of the battlefield that speak to you?
Yes, Culp's Hill is my favorite for a lot of reasons, but the main reason is that is the home regiment that I've always been very loyal to and did a lot of research on. And they fought on Geary Avenue at the base of Culp's Hill. Across right along Pardee Field is where they fought. So that's why I am very, very fond of that area.
With Remembrance Day coming up, and you guys are the experts, I guess we'll start with Sue. Are there any tips do you have for people who are coming to the battlefield for Remembrance Day? Are there places they should go see? Are there things they should stop by and see first? What tips do you have?
They need to get a licensed battlefield guide to do it right. I mean, there's no question. It's a huge battlefield. It's a big, deep story. And honestly, nobody can encapsulate it coherently like a guide can. So I would always recommend taking the expert on the field. But the other thing is, of course, the National Cemetery being the focus of Remembrance Day, that's a must do in November. Pretty much there's so very much, and it's so varied by interest, by personal interest. I personally tell people to get out of the car and read monuments because they're my favorite part of the field, physically speaking.
Jim, will you be at Remembrance Day? Do you have tips for those going there to this coming on weekend?
Well, I'm actually giving a tour on Saturday, so I won't be at the activities themselves, but I will be on the field on Saturday. What kind of tips would I give them? Check the weather forecast for one. But I mean, in terms of, you know, seeing the battlefield while you're here in town, obviously, you know, we've touched on Little Round Top being closed. And while that tends to disappoint a lot of the common visitors and things like that, again, it's an opportunity to see other stuff. I would say, obviously, we've talked about Culp's Hill. That's a great place to go. We've talked about the cemetery. That's obviously a must do this weekend. But, you know, if you're trying to get out on the battlefield and you're hiring that licensed battlefield guide, this is usually a good weekend, maybe even to get out onto the first day's battlefield, because, you know, you kind of avoid some of the town related congestion that's going to ensue from the parade and things like that. And, you know, like people have said, that there's a lot of great stories associated with Culp's Hill that I would agree with. I think there's a lot of great stories associated with the first day's battlefield that, you know, often too get untapped or maybe untouched in the bigger picture. So Sue's right. You got to hire a licensed battlefield guide. We don't just do the general 2-hour loop around the battlefield. If you've got a topic you're interested in, there's somebody on the guide force who can tackle it.
I was giving a practice tour on Remembrance Day one year in the morning, and I was giving a tour to my childhood neighbor, and she had never been to the battlefield before, but it was such a cool time to go out that morning because the different reenactment units go out and they lay wreaths and have their own private ceremonies at their monuments. So you get to go around and you see the differences in the uniforms of all the people that would have been there in the battle. So it's like you get to see the soldiers in the spot on the battlefield that morning. So like 10 o'clock is a great time to be out before all the roads start closing for the parade and all of that.
So you have a Civil War roundtable and you want to get the members new t-shirts. Maybe you want to design a smart new logo for that brand new social media campaign. But the graphic design artist you reached out to got everything wrong. Instead of crossed rifles, he had crossed pikes and matchlocks. Instead of Grant's portrait, it was Oliver Cromwell. Yes, they didn't know which Civil War you were talking about, but a mistake like this wouldn't happen if you use 1863 Designs, the leading graphic designer in the American Civil War community. Link in the show notes. Well, Fred, I know you mentioned the story of Little Round Top and how much you really, really love it, you know? But if someone is coming to the battlefield and all they know about Gettysburg is the movie Gettysburg, and they've seen the scene with Little Round Top, and you want to actually sit down with them, Little Round Top is not accessible. You want them to see something else of the battlefield, learn something else, another story. What tip would you give them? Where would you point them? What direction to learn more?
Well, if that's, you got to start with what they know. So if Gettysburg movie is their Gettysburg experience, you got to build on that, whether you like it or not. And a lot of things I do is I explain. Well, I do a lot with the, take them into the Annex and National Cemetery where you have the Friend of Friend Memorial and talk about the myth of the Gettysburg movie and why they are there, not just because they wanted to deliberately mislead you, but they're trying to tell a story. They're not trying to necessarily tell you history. And that's not Tom Chamberlain leaning over top of Louis Armistead. That's Henry Bigham, and this is why that showed up that way. I would probably still, even with Little Round Top closed, take them over to Devil's Den where you can still see Little Round Top and you can tell them about what happened and how it differed from the movie and how it was the same in the movie. But you use what they know and build from that. So I certainly wouldn't, as some people that I know would completely diss the movie and everything in it for 2 hours. That's not what the visitor's paying for.
You know, it's a cliche, but that book and that movie have caused so many people to come here, and they've caused so many people to become interested in the topic that, like Fred said, I think if you go out and you just diss it for a couple hours, you're doing them and yourself kind of a disservice. It's a learning opportunity. It's a learning opportunity to introduce people to, you know, the broader story.
Interestingly enough, I find in my experience that fewer and fewer people have seen the movie. Mm-hmm.
I have that experience as well.
Yeah. 10 years ago, if you said the movie, everybody knew exactly what it was. Now you say, did you see the movie? Oh yeah, we're up in the cyclorama movie. We just saw that. They don't know what movie you're actually talking about.
Yeah.
Because that has been, what, 26 years since that thing came out?
I think we're going on 30.
Yeah, it might be 30.
I think.
Yeah, 1993 was the movie.
So right, unless it shows up somewhere.
When it came out, so.
You were what? How old?
Three.
Well, for someone who is interested in the battle and maybe even interested in becoming a guide, Jim, what reading would you guide someone towards and say, okay, this is the reading you should be looking at? I know you have your own books as well, but.
Oy, you had to give me that question, huh? No, first of all, I think the Licensed Battlefield Guides, we do have a recommended reading list. And although the list is a couple of years old, I'm not sure, Fred might know, I'm not sure when the last time was it was updated. It's going to give somebody a good baseline and then some, you know, but as we said earlier, I mean, the books just keep coming out and coming out and coming out. You know, obviously a good overall campaign study is obviously a requirement. But the other thing too, though, is people can't just focus on Gettysburg. So you've got to remember that the exam is going to cover at least general questions about the Civil War. So you need some general Civil War studies in there as well. It's just too many to cover. And I would highly encourage somebody to get a hold of the Battlefield Guides required reading list. Like I said, it's a few years old, but I think it's a good start.
That was updated in 2015. Was that the last testing cycle? 2016, something like that. Dr. Carol Reardon basically took it under her wings to revise and update that whole list. And it's got to be 4 or 5 pages long now.
Wow.
I think when I took it, we got a half a page reading list that had Coddington, Study in Command. It had Glenn Tucker's High Tide at Gettysburg. It had the Park's little 45 page booklet brochure, things like that. It is just the amount of material, I think, is overwhelming today that a prospective guide has to absorb. I would tell them just get a very good, high quality, general overview of the 3 days of the battle and the campaign. You know, something like a Stephen Sears or Noandre Trudeau, something like that. Start with that, read that a couple of times. And then if you branch out, you're not going to ever read everything on that reading list and completely understand it in a compact amount of time that you're preparing for a guide test. So start small, work your way up. There's many groups out there that hire Jim and hire Tim Smith and Gary Edelman and Sue, and they go out and they do extensive touring of the battlefield, multi-hour tours, walking tours. You know, get on those, see how touring actually is being done.
That's a great point, because I think a lot of people, at least my experience has been, I'll meet people who are maybe preparing for the exam or they're even sitting for the exam. And you'll kind of say, well, you know, how many licensed battlefield guides have you hired? And how many times have you taken the basic 2-hour car tour to understand what we do? And, you know, sometimes you'll encounter people who have never done that. You know, they want to be a guide, but they don't really have a good understanding of what we do. And they say stuff like, oh, well, you know, when I become a guide, I'm just going to give staff rides and or deal with military groups or that sort of thing. They don't understand the basic meat and potatoes of what we do, which is, you know, ultimately that 2-hour tour.
Jesse, was there any one or couple books that you leaned on heavily during your examination process to study?
Yeah, I really did use the Coddington book as like the Bible, because if there is any particular part of it that I wanted to know more about, it has really good footnotes and you can find where those sources came from and then look into those sources. So like the branching out kind of happens in the notes of that. And what I did was I bought, there's a map that I think the visitor center sells and has all of the monuments and little dots all over the map. And I framed it and put it on my wall so that if I was reading about regiments, I could like look up and find them and then like, okay, they all go together. All right. And then keep going. So it's kind of a slow process. I also printed out the order of battle and stuck that to another wall and then had little pictures of all the brigade commanders on it. So I'm a very visual person and kind of had to make my own thing. But yeah, I relied heavily on that book.
Sue, are you reading anything on Gettysburg right now that you would recommend to somebody?
You know, I do try to keep up with the new stuff, but funny you should ask, because for the first time in probably 3 years, I picked up a non-Gettysburg book that I'm really into, and it's Is This the Real Life of Queen? You know, the band? It's a pretty awesome book. But anyway, the trouble with the newer volumes is they're either deep, really deep, on a single small subject, or they're poorly done overviews. You really have to be careful what you recommend nowadays, because as I found out the hard way, anybody can write a book. So just because it's in print doesn't mean it's a valuable book. For the average person, I would recommend Sears, but to a person who wants to be a guide, I would recommend Coddington. So it depends on who's asking. But you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's a never-ending task to find good books about the Battle of Gettysburg that a lot of guides will tell you. They'll sit around and pick up the newest thing, and by the time they're done reading it, they've had a little conference on all the mistakes that were made in that book. So it's just really tough. But a lot of guides have written books, and I would always recommend them, because you can pretty much rest assured they know what they're talking about.
Well, I can't wait for the Queen Gettysburg tour, if that's going to be a
thing. Yeah, I'll work on that.
Well, what about the future of battlefield guiding? I mean, now with social media as it is now, with Instagram and Facebook and TikTok and you name it, and the internet, where are the licensed battlefield guides going to go? What do you see the future for guiding?
I think it will always be a basic overview of the battle on the battlefield. I don't think there's anything out there, virtual reality, I don't care what it is, that's going to replace walking that field. And there's nobody that can walk with you except a guide.
Well, the other thing that you have about it is that most of those things that you mentioned are pretty much one-way streets. You are taking, you are absorbing what it's giving you. Might be giving it to you in a very glitzy package, but I find it the most entertaining tours that I take, which is the vast majority of them, there's an interaction in the car. At least one, maybe more than one person is in there, and you're having a conversation.
Right.
Where you're giving information as part of 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours being with them on the field. There's just no way that an app or anything like that's going to be able to replace that experience. I think the problems that we have is guiding as a whole, I think, is getting lost in the grasses of all of these other ways to do things. We don't have control over our own, advertising, promotion. We just don't have that control over it that we need to compete with these other systems. I think that's the challenge we face as guides today, to have that, keep our head above the high growing grass, if that makes any sense.
Well, you know, also to Fred's point, there's so many other ways to get your information that one of the major problems that guides have today is other people who fancy themselves experts out here giving tours. You know, in some cases, they know better. They know that this is a federal property and that only federally licensed guides can do it. Other people, I'll let them plead ignorance once, but some people claim, oh, I didn't know you had to be a guide to give a tour on the battlefield. And there's an awful lot of people doing it.
I had the pleasure a number of years ago, one little round top, of having a German tour guide and a German tour group come up on there. We'd known these people. They come out of New York City and pick the groups up and take them around the country. And I knew enough German that I could tell exactly what he was telling him. This man was telling him about picket charging up that hill. Little round top, picket charged up here. Wow. So that's the misinformation.
Yeah.
That comes out when you don't have a fully licensed guide. You don't know what kind of stuff is going out there. And the sad thing, and the thing I always complain about, is those people on that bus go back and say about our guide at Gettysburg told us. Mm-hmm. Well, now you say guide at Gettysburg, well, that gets thrown back on us. We didn't have anything to do with that.
The thing is, you know, because sometimes I see people on social media say things like, oh, we should all be able to give tours at Gettysburg. And above and beyond the federal regulation around it, this rigorous exam process that we've been talking about tonight is designed to make sure people get correct information. I mean, that's ultimately what it's about. Not that somebody's coming here and getting incorrect information, but that they're getting the right stuff. And that goes, you know, as we said at the beginning, that goes back to 1915. It goes back to the wishes of the people who actually fought in the Battle of Gettysburg, that there be somebody here to give correct information. And that's why it's so important that we do have this licensed guide program, and why it needs to continue in the future, you know, above and beyond all of this digital stuff that's out there today.
I also think there's a confusion between what guides do and what interpretive park rangers do. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to let my colleagues expand on that, but there's a big difference. If you want a 45-minute snapshot, take a ranger program. Otherwise, if you want a real comprehensive tour, take a guide.
Park rangers they give specialized, very detailed programs in most cases. I always tell people, if they've gone on a tour with me, you've got the basics. Now, if you're really more interested, see what kind of park ranger program's going on this afternoon. You'll probably drill down a little bit more on the National Cemetery or on Pickett's Charge or something like that, whatever the program's on. They do those kind of very structured types of things. We don't. We're more generalists. Essentially, you've got to go out and you've got to deal with an 8-week campaign, a 3-day battle, and you got to get into 2 hours. And if you're on a tour center bus, you got to do a restroom stop with all of that. And we still, most of us can get that done in the time that we're given. And I think people that come off our tours have a general idea of what happened here when they actually leave. Maybe they'll go in and they'll read a little bit more. Maybe they'll never hear anything about it, Gettysburg again, but at least they've had a little bit of exposure to it.
Well, I think that's very important, because sometimes, especially now when I've been doing this podcast, when I talk about Untold Civil War, what I found out was that Untold could be a lot of different things to a lot of different people. For example, I did an episode on the Hunley, and I had a bunch of people message me back and they said they never knew anything about the Hunley. And I thought that was more or less known about, or talked about at least. So I can imagine that someone coming and taking one of the guided tours, it's a great place to start, and it gives you that entry level. And then you can dive into the other stuff, because the other stuff, if you go there first, you're going to be lost.
Although I just want to clarify, we do much more than entry level. So you can start with the 2-hour tour, and that can be an entry level overview. That can be an overview for the intermediate or even the, you know, the deeper person. You know, a lot of times the person gets in the car with you and might say, well, I know my Battle of Gettysburg, and I'm going to put you through your paces, battlefield guide. And, you know, and then you start talking to them and, well, you know, who's your favorite general? Oh, well, I'm a big General Chamberlain fan. And you kind of say, okay, and you can kind of start sizing them up. And I don't mean to criticize or make fun of anybody on that, but I don't want anybody listening to this to come away with the idea that we are only an overview for beginners. What we do well is we adapt. We adapt to the audience, we adapt to the skill level, we adapt to the needs, and we can go deep, we can go shallow with you. It really just depends on, you know, what seems to be in the best interests of that particular visitor. And 2 hours later, I can be in a car with a totally different group and take that to a totally different level. And I think that's one of the things we do really well.
Oh, there's no doubt, looking at the research that goes into becoming a guide, that you can do both. I mean, there's no doubt about that in my mind. Jim, are there specific times where someone can call and say, I'd like a tour from a licensed battlefield guide, and they might say, I want it on a specific unit or a specific person or a specific part of the battlefield, they really want to get into that? Can they request a specific tour?
Yeah, they sure can. I mean, we work out of a number of partners in the Gettysburg area. Obviously, you can start with the Association of Licensed Battlefield Guide office, and you can leave a message there, and you can leave a message and tell us when you're coming and what topic you want to do. I don't have that phone number handy, but I'm sure somebody might, or we can put it in the show notes or something. Likewise, Gettysburg Foundation, Gettysburg Heritage Center, there's other partners in town that do that as well. But the Association of Licensed Battlefield Guides, I mean, we have our own reservation hotline, and that's a great place to leave a message and tell us what specifically you want to do, and we'll try to match you up with somebody who can do that.
Just to tag on what Jim has said, no matter which venue you use to hire a guide, and there are half a dozen in a town now you can call. If you want something specific, you need to make that very clear up front. Not every guide is an expert on Dan Sickles in the peach orchard. I would direct that to Jim over myself in a minute. I can do it, but he'll give you a much better tour for it. I had an experience just a couple of weeks ago where when you book through the Gettysburg Foundation, they will give us tour notes. And the tour notes said, first day tour. Well, when I got here, it was two elderly brothers from Georgia who had never been here before. So I had to immediately question, well, why do you want to do just the first? Well, we didn't say that. We had an ancestor in the 14th Georgia, and we want to talk about the 14th. Well, the 14th Georgia really didn't ever fight on the first day. They were a second, third day type of unit. But the guide needs to know that a day, 2 days, 3 days in advance so they can prepare the idea of the tour of what they want. You can't just expect to walk in off the street, hire a guide and say, I want to do an in-depth drill down on 118th Pennsylvania. Sure, there's somebody that's going to be able to do it, but it's going to take a little bit of time for, I'd say, the vast majority of guides to be able to prep a tour like that, even just the logistics of it. So just be specific when you want to get one with a very detailed agenda.
Well, I will definitely be putting a link in the show notes to the association so people can get access to you all. And I just want to thank all of you for taking the time to come on the show, talk a little bit about the licensed battlefield guides. I know people talk about Gettysburg itself, but sometimes I feel the licensed battlefield guides, the heroes of today, the story gets a little overshadowed, and I'm glad we got to shine some light on them. Thank you so much for sharing the story. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
I learned some things about my fellow guides.
And hopefully I'll see you all on Remembrance Day. So,
all right, I'll be there.
Thank you for listening while you did your Christmas shopping, sipping on that eggnog, stuck on the brutal mud march, attending Mass with Father Corby, or whenever you listen to podcasts. Eager to see how my trip to Gettysburg for Remembrance Day went? Use the YouTube link in the show notes and subscribe to the YouTube channel so you don't miss out. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook to stay up to date and tune in next time for our next episode.